All right. The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Robert N. Davis presiding. All of our business before this court is on here. We shall be heard. God bless the United States and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Good morning. I'm Chief Judge Davis. To my right is Judge Allen. To my left is Judge Meredith. We are here today in the matter of BN against David Shulkin, MD, Secretary of the Veterans Affairs Department, and we're here on a motion for production of agency records. The issue before us is whether the All Writs Act authorizes the court to order the production of documents not before the board in the decision on appeal. Would counsel for both parties please note your appearance for the record? Great, thank you. Welcome. Are both parties ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
Okay, each party will have 30 minutes to present your respective arguments. Counsel for the appellant, do you wish to reserve any portion of your time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, I wish to reserve 12 minutes.
Okay. Thank you for standing. Counsel for the appellant is reserving 12 minutes. Okay, counsel, you may proceed. And I'll start right away. Have you submitted an FOIA request for the documents you're interested in?
Your Honor, BN has not submitted a FOIA request for the documents you're interested in. BN submitted the motion for production that we're speaking about today, requesting that this court use its All Writs Act power to order production of agency records necessary to adjudicate his general bias claim.
Well, why haven't you submitted a FOIA request?
Your Honor, FOIA is a completely separate statutory scheme. It would be unreasonable to require veterans to take on additional litigation to get the information that they need to adjudicate their due process right to a fair and impartial adjudicator.
Okay. The court already has jurisdiction in this case.
Correct.
Right? So the All Writs Act is in aid of the court's jurisdiction.
Correct.
How does conducting full-blown discovery aid the court's jurisdiction when it has jurisdiction already?
Your Honor, the AWA can be used to aid the court's jurisdiction that's already existing, and it would help this court, aid this court in its jurisdiction, because it would allow it to adjudicate the claim of general bias that BN hopes to bring on this appeal on the merits. The order of production would allow this court to have a fuller context of the general bias claim, one that we take very seriously, and allow this court to adjudicate that claim fully on the merits.
Why wasn't that raised at the board?
The board. When counsel for BN started to believe that there was general bias in this claim, a final board decision had already been issued. At that point, BN chose to pursue a notice of appeal and appear before this court. This court is a better forum to adjudicate a general bias claim because it doesn't require BN to bring a bias claim before the very VLJ that he's accusing of bias. Courts in analogous contexts have demonstrated that bringing a bias claim before the very judge that you're accusing of bias could be futile. And so, in interest of having a fair and impartial adjudication of his bias claim, he proceeded to this court and is asking that this court use its AWA power broadly and flexibly to order production necessary to fully adjudicate that general bias claim on the merits.
What is the purpose of your citation to Whitney against Dick in 1906?
The purpose of that is to demonstrate that this court does have AWA power to order production in this case and that there is broad and flexible power to do so.
And do you have cases that, any support at all, that provides the authority of an appellate court to conduct discovery?
There have been cases in analogous contexts that have indicated that appellate courts can order discovery when necessary. I believe in the case Gonzalez v. INS that we cited in our papers, that court indicated that an appellate court could, you know, look at agency records necessary to adjudicate a general bias claim.
Well, looking at records is a little different than conducting full-blown discovery, isn't it? I mean, the Cox case involves looking at records that you cited in your brief as well. But you're asking us to conduct discovery on alleged statistical information, and this court heretofore has not done that before. What makes you think that this is an appropriate case for us to do that in now?
You're correct, Your Honor. This court has not done this before, but this is an appropriate case to order production because of the very serious and sensitive nature of this claim. It's apparently the case of first impression that a veteran hasn't brought a general bias claim like this before. And due to the serious nature of that claim, we'd ask that this court use its AWA power to order production so that it can have the information necessary to fully adjudicate that claim. You're correct that we have presented a prima facie case of general bias using the statistics in our paper. The VLJ in this case has only granted one male MST claim and her 10 years on the board, and that accounts for a 2.8% grant rate compared to a 44% grant rate for female MST claimants. Mm-hmm. Additional FOIA production by the Organization of Protective Defenders indicates that the national average rate for male MST grant rates for all VLJs is 29.7%. There's a stark discrepancy between the VLJ in this case's grant rates for male MST claimants compared to her colleagues and compared to her grant rates for female MST claimants. That demonstrates at the very minimum a prima facie case of general bias. And so we ask that this court order production necessary to flesh out that prima facie case and to understand whether general bias really is an issue here. We take this claim very seriously, and we ask that the court have all the information it needs to adjudicate the general bias claim.
Are you comfortable with your statistics?
We are comfortable with our statistics.
You didn't talk about remand rates in your statistics.
We did not. The remand rates are not, I think, helpful in this.
They don't support your position.
I don't think that's necessarily true. So the remand rates.
Are you respectfully disagreeing with my point?
I respectfully disagree.
Okay.
The remand rates indicate that there's still a discrepancy between the way in which the VLJ in this case is adjudicating male and female claimants. If you refer to our motion, you'll notice that the remand rate for male MST claimants is higher than the remand rate for female MST claimants, indicating a difference in the way that male and female MST claimants are being treated. And furthermore, a remand is neither a grant nor a denial. And so I don't know if it can be dispositive of whether or not this VLJ is not biased against male MST claimants.
Your overall number is incomplete, though, doesn't it?
I think it indicates that it would be helpful to have more information, which is why we're asking this court to order production necessary to have a full and more precise picture of what is going on with this VLJ.
Wouldn't this be more appropriate at the board level? Shouldn't this type of discovery be conducted there as opposed to here?
We respectfully disagree, Your Honor. This would not be not appropriate at the board level because of the nature of the claim. Because this is a general bias claim, one that is very sensitive and one that would require the VLJ in this case to decide her own bias, we think that would be inappropriate and not lead to the necessary fair and impartial adjudication of this claim. This court, with its separation from the board, has the ability to rule on a general bias claim fair and impartially. It also has the ability to add the information that it could get from ordering production under its All Writs Act power through the exceptions outlined in Bell v. Derwinski, as well as Munzingo v. Shinseki. In those cases, this court recognized that when information was constructively before the VA and also generated by the VA and had a direct relationship to the issues on appeal, it could be added to the record on appeal. So we'd ask that this court order production, add it to the record, and then proceed to the merits to adjudicate this general bias claim.
Given the statutory scheme here that does not include a discovery statute, is the All Writs Act provisions that you're suggesting we apply consistent with our statutory scheme?
Yes, Your Honor, they are consistent with the statutory scheme because there isn't an to utilize All Writs Act, it can be used broad and flexibly in aid of jurisdiction already existing, and as long as it doesn't contravene positive law, it is within the court's power. There's no discovery motion here, so this could, the AWA could be used to supplement the statutory scheme and help this court aid its jurisdiction. This court is the appropriate forum for this motion because there's still information necessary to adjudicate this general bias claim. We're asking that this court provide agency records detailing the overall grant and denial rates disaggregated by gender and also claim type. In the FOIA production for protection of offenders, the VA provided information related to PTSD claims disaggregated by gender, but not the other types of claims that result from PTSD, namely major depressive disorder or general anxiety disorder. So we'd ask that this court order to produce the additional claim types disaggregated. We'd also ask that this court provide records of individual VLJs so that there can be a sense of whether or not the VLJ in this case is an outlier. We'd also ask that this court provide internal memorandum guidance related to MST claims. This will help show whether or not the board has presented VLJs with information after the findings in AZ v. Shinseki changed the standard required for the personal assault regulation. And we'd also ask that this court provide internal memoranda and guidance related to bias claims. So the board has been directing the VLJs and how they should be.
Could I jump in for a second? I've sort of two questions here. First, what's your position about whether an individual VLJ could order production of this type of material? That's number one. And number two, I think the Secretary noted that, and the Chief Judge noted in one of his questions, that there have been others who have requested similar material under FOIA. Is there anything that you could get through the All Writs Act here that you were not able, that one would not be able to get through FOIA? So those are my two questions.
Yes, Your Honor. For your first question, although the board does have the power to gather facts and information, in this case it wouldn't be appropriate to have the board gather this information that we're requesting on production because it relates to a general bias claim. So we'd be asking the VLJ that we're...
No, I get that point, and that's a sort of a metaphysical point. If you think I'm right, if you think I'm just generically biased against law schools from Connecticut, it's going to be hard for me to recognize that that might be the case. Right? I get that. My point is, or my question is, what's your position about whether an individual VLJ has the power to get the types of statistics that you're asking for? So here's the example. Assume that we're VLJs, and I wanted to find out the percentage of cases involving military sexual trauma that Judge Meredith granted versus not. Would I have the authority to get that information?
Yes.
An individual VLJ could then obtain the information about every other VLJ disaggregated by their claim type, et cetera, grant rate, all of that?
Yes, it's my understanding that they would have the power to do that.
And how would they do that?
There is a regulation at the board that is a subpoena regulation that they could use to get that information. Additionally, the VA has a duty to assist.
But a subpoena, right, one would not normally think of a subpoena issued to yourself, right? I mean, that's what you're saying. So this is important for me to know your position about this, because if, in fact, the VLJs have the authority using the subpoena power to obtain exactly the information that you requested here, I will tell you that is a real negative for your position, because your client did absolutely nothing. And, you know, maybe it would be futile, maybe it wouldn't be, but if the VLJ could have obtained all of this information themselves, that's a really difficult position.
In this case, Your Honor, I don't think that the subpoena regulation would not be adequate. First, it doesn't seem to facially contemplate this case in general. The subpoena regulation has a caveat that you have to, a veteran needs to motion for subpoena at least 30 days before their hearing. In Bien's case, his personal hearing was in 2014, and he did not discover indicia of bias until 2016, and so the subpoena regulation wasn't available to him. So in this circumstance, the subpoena regulation is inadequate to get the information that we're asking this court to produce.
But if somebody were able to comply with the 30-day rule and all of that, you think that the subpoena power would reach this? Who would the VLJ issue the subpoena to?
I'm actually not sure, Your Honor. I think in this case, the subpoena power is inadequate, and going further, I think it would be perhaps necessary for this court to clarify how the subpoena power could be used in a general bias claim. I think in a general bias claim, it doesn't appear that the subpoena would be an effective tool to get the production of the records that we're asking for here. It seems that AWA power would allow this court to get the production of records that we're asking for without the administrative inadequacy.
And then the second question being, is there any light between what the AWA could authorize versus what could be obtained through FOIA?
Yes, Your Honor. There is. There are exceptions to FOIA, things that cannot be gotten through that statutory scheme, and so the All Writs Act would allow for those exceptions that FOIA has.
So, yes, and in the abstract, I definitely agree with you. In the concrete situation of this case, you've asked for four things, basically, four categories of things. Are any of those categories that you believe or have been told in other settings would not be obtainable through FOIA?
I cannot say for certain, but based on the production, the FOIA production that was given to Protect Our Defenders, it seems that perhaps the VLJs disaggregated by individual VLJ might not be able to get through FOIA. And then, of course, as I said before, there are abstract exceptions, so there definitely is a possibility that the VA would have exceptions to the other things that we're asking for.
Ms. Schaefer, let me pick up on a question that Judge Allen asked regarding the VLJs, and let's assume for a moment that the VLJs generally, all 80-something of them, may not have the authority to get you the information that you want. But what about the chief ALJs? There are about 10 chief ALJs at the department, or at the board, as I understand it. Would they be in a different position than the regular ALJs, or VLJs, I'm sorry?
Yes, Your Honor, it seems that they would be in a different position because of the different stature on the board, but it's not clear that in this instance they would have been able to produce the production that we're asking for here.
So you don't really know if you could get this information from the VLJs at this point?
No, Your Honor, I do not.
Okay.
Could I go back to something you mentioned earlier? You're arguing that the information you're seeking was constructively possessed by the board. If that's true, why would we need to exercise all writs authority to get that information? Why wouldn't we just go through the standard procedures that the court has for amending the record before the agency if something is constructively found to have been before the board?
In this case, Your Honor, the information that we're requesting is not part of BN's record, and so we're asking for AWA production because it's more broad and flexible power that allows for the information that we require for this general bias claim.
But if it was constructively considered to have been before the board, then it's considered part of the record of proceedings or record before the agency. wouldn't our own process be adequate if it is constructively before the board?
That could be the case, Your Honor.
So as to whether or not it's constructively considered before the board, you acknowledge that there needs to be a direct relationship between the material and the appeal.
Yes.
When does that relationship have to be apparent? Is it at the time of the board decision, or can you now retroactively make an argument that makes it appear as though it should have been relevant? Did the board have to be on notice that it was relevant at that time?
No, Your Honor. In this case, to have a direct relationship to the issues on appeal is to mean that it has to be directly related to issues that will be briefed on the merits and the merits of this appeal, and a general bias claim will be, I'm sorry, I see that my time has elapsed.
Do you have any?
One second. Could you add 2 minutes, please?
Any of our cases that support that the direct relationship doesn't need to be apparent until later on, that it didn't need to be apparent at the time of the board decision?
Other than Munzingo v. Shinseki, I'm not aware of any additional cases that discuss the direct relationship.
So you also mentioned in your supplemental pleadings that you believe the court has the authority to create an exception to 7252B, which requires us to consider just the evidence that was of record. What's your authority for suggesting that we could create an exception to that statutory prohibition?
Yes, Your Honor. The exception to 7252B comes from this court's case law in Bell v. Drewinsky and Munzingo v. Shinseki. Those are two cases that discuss when this court can supplement the record on appeal, and the test outlined in Bell v. Drewinsky is, like you said, I said before, constructively before the VA and generated by the VA and with a direct relationship to the matters on appeal.
It's not really an exception. It's that we find certain materials were part of or should have been a part of the record.
Correct, Your Honor. And in this case, we feel that this information is vital to be added to the record because of the general bias claim that BN will bring. It's fundamental that BN and all other veterans have a due process right to a fair and impartial adjudicator.
As we were discussing earlier, some of the materials that you're asking for were obtained through a different FOIA request, and your client has now been provided with some of that material. Does that in part moot your motion?
It doesn't moot our motion, Your Honor, because there is information that we requested from this court in the motion for reduction that was not received through the FOIA request that Protect Our Defenders received. If Your Honor would go to our motion for reduction, I can talk through the information that we still think is relevant and has not been produced through FOIA. The first is the grant denial rates by all VLJs disaggregated by claim type. The FOIA production only had a disaggregation by gender, but by PTSD and non-PTSD. But there are other injuries that veterans suffer from military sexual trauma that are major depressive disorder, general anxiety disorder, and those were not disaggregated. We also asked that this court provide the grant denial rates for VLJs disaggregated by individual VLJ to determine whether or not the VLJ in this case is an outlier. We asked for the internal memoranda related to military sexual trauma claims to see if the board has directed VLJs to adjudicate military sexual trauma claims differently after the AZ v. Shinseki standard was required. We also asked for internal memoranda and guidance related to general bias, whether or not the board has directed the VLJs in relating to bias.
Under the Federal Circuit's decision in KIND in 7252B, we lack jurisdiction to consider extra record material. So if these materials are not considered to have been constructively before the board, are we prohibited from considering them and deciding your appeal?
You're correct, Your Honor, that 7252B and KIND do indicate that the record on appeal is what this court should review, but under Bell v. Drewinsky and Munzingo v. Shinseki, there are allowances that this court can make for information that is constructively before the VA and pertinent to the issues on appeal. In this case, these records are necessary for this court to more fully and more precisely adjudicate a general bias claim and are very much necessary for the information, this claim on appeal.
Thank you, counsel. Your time is up.
Thank you.
Ms. King-Holland, I will add 4 minutes to your time if you need it.
Okay, thank you.
You may proceed.
The court should deny appellant's motion for the production of agency documents. As a threshold matter, this court has jurisdiction over the underlying board decision, and the exercise of its power under the All Writs Act is not appropriate in this case. Even if the court finds that the All Writs Act is applicable, appellant has not demonstrated that he has exhausted his administrative remedies. Now, there are two central reasons that the motion should be denied. One, the court is precluded from considering extra record evidence on appeal because of the limitations that Congress enacted under 7252 and 7261.
Judge Meredith indicated there may be some constructive possession issues here.
So
what happens in that instance?
Yes, Your Honor. The argument that appellant has raised is that under Bail v. Derwinski, occasionally the court has reviewed evidence that was constructively before the agency. However, Bail was the holding in Bail was confined to this court's previous procedure, where the court was reviewing evidence that and some of that evidence was, in fact, constructively before the board. It was not evidence that was generated after a board decision specific to a particular request for for additional information.
If I can jump in with that, though, isn't the real problem here is that all of the doctrines that we're talking about are essentially the square pegs. And this situation really is more of the round hole. And what I mean by that is in Bell and in our recent case Turner that came out last week, when we're talking about constructive possession or when we talk about facts in some of these situations and record before the agency, we're actually talking about, in those cases, the actual facts of what happened. You know, was the person stationed at Miramar or whatever? Here, the facts that we're talking about are facts about whether the adjudicator, him or herself, in this case, had a bias that is unconstitutional. So they're both facts, but they're facts in a very different way. So what's your position about that?
Our position is that Kine v. Shinseki is the controlling case in this particular case. In Kine, the court, Federal Circuit, held that in considering an assertion that VA did not properly notify him as to the time and place of a scheduled VA examination, it exceeded its jurisdiction under 7252B by considering extra record evidence as to whether VA had a regular practice of notifying claimants of such examinations. And although the dissenting judge found it significant that the extra record evidence was not used to adjudicate the merits of the claim, the majority did not find that distinction sufficient to depart from the general rule under 7252B. There are exceptions where the court finds that judicial notice is appropriate in a certain situation. However, appellant has not argued that this is material that the court could consider in the first instance. It would not be material that the court could take judicial notice over.
So is it your position that on remand, so assume this got remanded, something that almost never happens, right? But just assume it got remanded. Is it your position that the board member would have the ability to provide all of the information, to obtain all of the information that the appellant has requested?
Yes, the information that appellant has requested would be appropriate for additional development for the board to make a finding in the first instance as to whether or not there is, a constitutional due process claim here. But it is our fundamental position that this court statutory scheme really prohibits this type of discovery motion. Under 7252B, the court is limited to the review of documents that are in the record before the proceeding, that were before the secretary and the board. Coupled with 7261, the court is limited from making findings of is limited to the findings of fact made by the secretary and the board before the agency. It is a statutory authority and not the All Writs Act that is controlling here. In Pennsylvania Bureau of Correction, Although the All Writs Act empowers federal courts to fashion extraordinary remedies when the need arises, it does not authorize them to issue ad hoc writs whenever compliance with statutory procedures are inconvenient or less appropriate. And although the All Writs Act allows the court to reach more cases, it in no way grants the court more power or an ability to override statutory prohibitions in cases already within its jurisdiction. So, for example, if Chapter 72 precludes discovery of extra record evidence and an appellant cannot simply append an All Writs Act motion to his appeal, as appellant has attempted to do here, in order to avoid a statutory preclusion. Although appellant has cited to numerous cases where U.S. district courts have used the All Writs Act to produce information, the use of the All Writs Act cannot wholly vitiate the Chapter 72 limitations established by Congress.
But you know, again, this is the round peg square hole issue. You know, our system is totally, totally unique. You know, we can debate about whether Congress thought about it at all when they made it, but they made a very strange system. And so trying to analogize, well, you know, courts of appeal don't generally do this. Well, that's true, but we're the only game in town in this particular system, right? So that doesn't necessarily get us all that far, does it?
Well, the court is prohibited from reviewing extra record evidence, as we've discussed in Kine. They have not asserted that judicial notice is appropriate here. And the other key piece here is that they have not established that they attempted to exhaust their administrative remedies in this case. They did not file a FOIA request prior to this appeal. They did not seek to file a motion for reconsideration, a motion to vacate. They did not file a motion for recusal of the judge.
Let's separate these things out, okay? So, first of all, the FOIA is different from all the rest.
Yes, it's
right?
A separate system.
Right. So, I'm not aware of any doctrine of administrative exhaustion that requires the exhaustion of something that isn't part of the administrative process. So, for me, I would take FOIA out of the administrative exhaustion. It might play another role, but do you have any authority to suggest that something that is outside of the administrative process also needs to be exhausted?
It's the exhaustion of administrative remedies under Majid v. West is actually a test. So it's not as though we're looking at a list of checklists to check off each item that they must have exhausted. But because of the unique statutory scheme of this particular court and the specific preclusion in reviewing extra record evidence and making factual findings in the first instance, In this case, a consideration of the test in Majid is appropriate.
I don't understand what Majid has to do with this. My question is much simpler.
Okay.
Anywhere in any system, because there's administrative exhaustion requirements in tons and tons and tons of systems, are you aware of any administrative exhaustion doctrine that requires the exhaustion of something outside of that administrative process? So take, for example, prison litigation. If a prisoner is going to go to court under the Prison Litigation Reform Act, he or she has to exhaust administrative remedies, but they're all at the prison, right? We're not saying that you have to go somewhere else to do something. And so it's not meant as a trick question. I'm just trying to figure out which parts of this exhaustion thing we have to consider.
I think it's relevant in a more holistic way in that even though FOIA is a separate system and that there's a separate right of appeal to district court, a consideration as to how to get the specific documents in unique situations is appropriate. It is appropriate for the court to consider FOIA as part of that. The records that they've requested are records that are appropriate for a FOIA request. In fact, through the counsel here has submitted a FOIA request that's currently pending before the agency on behalf of other parties, and many of their requests in that FOIA request do overlap. And the board did submit 52 pages of documents detailing, providing information to them that does overlap with the information that they've requested in this particular case. But alternatively, even if the court finds that 7252B, 7261C, the administrative, the exhaustion of the administrative remedies doctrine are all not applicable in this case, the appropriate course of action would be a remand for additional development for the board to make a determination in the first instance as to the as to appellant's constitutional claim.
Counsel, you mentioned recusal and reconsideration as well as options for administrative exhaustion. Let's talk about recusal for a moment. As I understood appellant's counsel, they did not have the information before them at the time of the initial hearing before the VLJ. So how could a recusal have worked?
The appellant in this particular case did have a previous history with the particular VLJ in that there was a 2014 remand in which the board remanded the claim for additional development in this case to include obtaining additional Social Security administrative documents and an additional VA examination. And despite the remand in that particular instance, he filed a petition for extraordinary relief with the Veterans Court with the claim that the judge was, that the board was arbitrarily refusing to act in the claim. So there was a past history with this particular
And Judge
VLJ.
Denied that.
Yes, and that petition was, in fact, denied. And although the motion, although 19.12, the regulation itself, is vague as to the exact procedure as to filing a motion for recusal of a particular judge, the board entertains motions regularly, including motions for recusal. And specifically, if this court finds that additional development is necessary in this case and that a remand is the appropriate recourse for the board to address the constitutional matter in the first instance, it would be the particular VLJ in this case would be she would recuse herself, as well as the order from the court could require that it goes to another judge, and that order would have to be complied with by the board.
But we'd have to find some, before we did any of that, right, we would have to find some error, wouldn't we, in the board decision?
Under Majeed and under the court's holding in Sanders v. Brown, the court has in the past found that where it's a constitutional issue at play and there's additional development necessary in the case, and that the constitutional claim in and of itself cannot be decided on the record before the court, that a remand is the appropriate recourse.
Even with no, I mean, I understand the Majeed type remands to be based on error, right? To be based on new legal arguments that one would allow the board to consider in the first instance. Would you be lumping this into that same category?
Yes, Your Honor.
So if we remanded and we directed it go to a different VLJ, what would that VLJ do? Would that VLJ re-adjudicate the claim, or would he or she only do the constitutional analysis?
That would, the purpose of the remand would be for additional development on the constitutional claim. And so it would go back to the VLJ, but any argument could be made as to the substantive board decision before when it goes back to the board as well.
Right, so the reason I'm explaining this is that
solely to the constitutional claim.
So the reason I'm asking is that if in fact then everything gets back on the table, if we were to take that authority, this makes the whole argument here today a little bizarre, right? Because that would get rid of the problem. Right, I mean, literally, with no other action at all, other than sending it back to a different VLJ, that would get rid of the problem of a constitutional flaw in this particular decision based on general bias, right?
Well, if it goes back to a particular VLJ for additional development, which is what we are dealing with here, it's simply a motion for production of agency documents. There is a present time, there is no constitutional claim other than to say we would like additional development to support our theory as to a possibility of bias by a VLJ. So it can, and the court has in the past, there's Rosalina v. Brown, there's Sanders v. Brown, where the court has determined where it's a constitutional claim and additional development is necessary, remand is the appropriate recourse for the board to address in the first instance the constitutional claim and conduct an additional development as necessary.
Would the secretary be, you know, what I'm trying to do is find a way to actually resolve this, right? Because I think the secretary would agree that if there were systemic bias versus male claims versus female claims in either direction, that that's a problem that should be addressed. I would assume.
Yes, that is a problem that would be addressed. The particular facts in this case, you know, it's because of the nature of the appellate court scheme and the statutory scheme, the court is discovery is simply precluded in its statutory scheme.
So in order to address
the merits of some of these more complex issues where we have a fact pattern that doesn't fit in the exact model of every case that we've seen before, I think that's where we have to work within the frame that the court has set up.
And that's what I'm trying to get out, is that I'm trying to do what a magistrate judge in Florida said, which is lawyers and judges are problem solvers, okay? And so I'm following up on one of your suggestions, is that if we start out with the fact that everybody agrees that if this were the case, it would be serious, okay? That there would be, if there were unconstitutional and unconscious bias affecting this, that would be bad. Everybody agrees that. We don't have the authority, according to the Secretary, to obtain the information ourselves and make a determination in the first instance, right? But if it went back, the Secretary agrees that an individual VLJ, even if it were a different one, could explore this issue and develop the record, right?
Yes, that's correct.
And maybe that would involve a new adjudication of the substantive claim. Maybe it wouldn't. We don't know. I mean, do I have that so far basically right?
Yes, that is correct.
Then I wonder why wouldn't the Secretary be willing to agree to the remand for that purpose? Because otherwise it sends, I will just tell you, right, and this may not affect the legal merits, it sends a message that the department is not serious about finding out whether there's a constitutional violation, because we see lots of joint motions to remand for things that I think may be less, quote, important than whether or not there is systemic, gender-based, unconscious discrimination.
The reason is in part in the court's own process. So we are currently in a stage of litigation where we are simply establishing the record before the court. And at that stage, we simply have a motion for production of agency documents. Under the court's statutory scheme, the court is precluded from reviewing documents that were not before the secretary and not before the board, and where the secretary and the board have not made findings on an argument before the court. So in light of the statutory construction, the court is precluded under 7252B, 7261C, from read together, these two statutes preclude the court from reviewing newly developed documents that were not before the board and the secretary, and from making findings of fact in the first instance.
Would anything preclude the secretary from agreeing to a remand here?
That's our alternative argument, is that alternatively, if the court finds that 7252B, 7261C, the court's holding in kind, and the exhaustion of administrative remedies are all not applicable in this case, the appropriate course of action would be for the court to remand the claim for additional development.
That's the part of the argument I'm not understanding from you, which is probably me, not you, is that whether or not we can look at something, what I'm trying to do is figure out, you say the only place that this can be developed is at the board, right? So if the secretary is not concerned about hiding, I don't mean that pejoratively, but, you know, not investigating this type of thing, and the only place it can be done is at the board, unless there's something precluding the secretary from agreeing to a remand for development, I'm just trying to understand why the fact that we can't look at facts affects the Secretary's ability to take that action.
Because we have a current motion that is attempting to allow the court to get involved in some discovery. And the problem with that is that if a petitioner, an AWA petitioner, has the ability to receive court-ordered discovery and de novo factual findings by the court, these are remedies that are unavailable to appellants who have followed the ordinary appellate procedure. And in light of this particular motion and the fact that we haven't had a briefing conference, we haven't got to the substantive issues in this case, we are simply at the RBA stage where we are attempting to establish the record before the agency, before the court, so we can move on to the substantive issues in this case. So as a result, it's the Secretary's position that alternatively, if the court finds that the exhaustion administrative remedies doctrine is not applicable in this case, the court has in the past determined that where additional development is necessary for a constitutional claim, the appropriate remedy would be a remand.
All right, but Judge Allen just suggested that we in our role as judges and you all in your role as lawyers are problem solvers. And given the many, many thousands of cases in this field affecting veterans, particularly those at the department, close to 500,000 cases waiting for decision-making there, and about 150,000 at the board waiting for hearing and final decision. Does it not make sense that perhaps you could have picked up the phone and called the appellant's counsel and said, well, what about a remand? Or, better yet, let's say after you walk out these doors today, given the questions that you've been asked, and you decide to discuss this process with opposing counsel, and all of a sudden the case goes away, and we don't have to make a decision because you resolve it. Is that a possibility? I'm just curious in terms of problem solving.
In terms of problem solving, I would say that could possibly be a possibility, but we have a pending motion before the court for production of documents.
Right.
And so it's the Secretary's position.
But you know how I would have felt had I seen a motion that would come here before we had oral argument that said, oh, by the way, we resolve this?
We did, in our pleading, suggest to the court that that was our alternative. Alternatively, if the court finds that that the 7252B, 7261C, the exhaustion of administrative remedies doctrine are all not applicable in this case, the appropriate recourse and appropriate action from the court would be a remand for additional development on the constitutional issue.
Do lawyers today talk to each other anymore?
Yes, we do on a regular basis.
I'm just curious.
All right.
Could I get back to the constructive possession issue?
Yes.
Under Munsingo, there has to be a direct connection between the information that's being sought and the appeal. When does that relationship have to be apparent? Is it prior to the board decision on appeal, or can it become apparent from arguments that are made later on at the court?
It's prior to the board's decision. The holding in Bell is really confined to, that holding, the court is limited to the evidence that was physically part of the record before the board, are constructively part of the record by virtue of being generated by the agency before the date of the board decision. Bell and Munsingo don't necessarily contemplate documents that and information that has to be generated after a board decision, such as in this particular case, the documents that they've requested involve analyzing the board's databases to separate out by each particular VLJ their grant rate, denial rate, and the remand rate for a 10-year period, and separating those out by gender, by claim type, and those claims are all divided by diagnostic code. So it is a complicated process that judicial notice would not be appropriate in this particular instance where it's this information really is not facts of universal notoriety that would not be subject to reasonable dispute as the court anticipated in Tegupa, where they took judicial notice over a memorandum of understanding. The type of information that they requested is akin to discovery. It's the type of information that the court is precluded from considering as part of extra record evidence.
All
Could I follow up with one question, because Judge Meredith has asked both parties about this, related to, that's not the exact language, from Munzingo, I guess. If your position is that the board member, the VLJ on remand, would be able to use subpoena power to obtain all of this information, doesn't that mean it has to be related to the claim? I mean, that doesn't get to Judge Meredith's point about the time, but it would have to be related, because otherwise I can't imagine the subpoena could be used to obtain unrelated information.
They could use subpoena power, but they can also, through their duty to assist, order additional development through the agency. So
right.
there are different mechanisms in which they can obtain
information. Right, I'm not worried about the mechanism. My point, whatever mechanism,
okay,
even if it was a Harry Potter wand, would be
okay,
they would have to be related to the matters in the appeal, right?
That is correct.
So leaving aside the time issue then for a second, in terms of the Bell versus Dewinsky issue, you have to be taking the position that this information is related to the appeal, with the time issue as to exactly when, right?
Right.
I mean,
the information is related to the appeal, and the constitutional claim was not before the board. So in light of the way that Bell versus Dewinsky was created, and that particular case was factually related to the old system where the information before the court was not necessarily the entire claims file, and there was a possibility that information that a veteran had provided to the agency was not immediately before the board. It was a different system. And now we have a much more comprehensive system, and the entire claims file is through our electronic system is now before the board. So it's a different system, and Kine v. Shinseki is really the controlling case in this particular case, because in Kine, the Federal Circuit specifically found that affidavits created by VA employees detailing a process that they used to schedule VA examinations, that was, in fact, extra record evidence. And the court can consider evidence that it finds that it can take judicial notice of, but in that particular case, the Federal Circuit found that it could not take judicial notice over affidavits from VA employees because it was not facts of universal notoriety or facts that are not subject to reasonable dispute.
The counsel, based on your representations regarding the alternative administrative remedies, there's no information that the appellant's counsel would be deprived of if they had sought or would seek additional administrative remedies. Is that correct? In all categories of the areas they have an interest in getting statistical information, if they were to present those requests to a VLJ in some form, the VLJ would be able to provide that information to? Yeah.
VLJ would be able to order additional development to be conducted in the case to comply with the information that they've requested. I do want to note on a separate note, the FOIA request that's currently pending before the agency does include their request for specific claims for each particular judge, including those claims for MST cases in particular. And that particular request was remanded from the Office of General Counsel back to the board for additional response. And if, in fact, that FOIA request, if they're not satisfied with the information provided by the board, they have a separate right of appeal in district court for that particular
So that is being currently worked, it sounds like.
There is a separate system for the FOIA.
Mm-hmm.
In sum, this court has jurisdiction over the underlying board decision, and the exercise of its power under the All Writs Act is not appropriate in this case. And even if the court finds that 7252B, 7261C, the court's Federal Circuit's holding in Kine, and the exhaustion of administrative remedies doctrine are all not applicable in this case, the appropriate course of action would be for the court to remand the claim for additional development regarding the appellant's constitutional due process claim.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honors. This court can and must clarify how a veteran may bring the same sort of general bias claim that Social Security claimants and immigrants facing deportation and others may bring. We ask this court, therefore, to exercise its authority under the All Writs Act to order production in this case. Regarding remand, we'd like to note that we would only consent to a remand if it was to a different BLJ. Should this court choose to remand to a different BLJ, we would additionally ask this court set a schedule for decision by the board, we suggest 60 days, ask the secretary to identify any errors which he agrees should be addressed on remand, and that this court clarify again how veterans may bring a general bias claim in the future.
I don't understand the last thing you just said.
Yes, Your Honor. We ask this court to clarify how veterans may bring a general bias claim because on their face, the regulations before the board do not appear to allow a veteran to bring a general bias claim. For example, the judicial recusal statute regulation appears to only permit a VLJ to recuse themselves.
Well, I agree with that. I think that the way the recusal regulation is written on its face wouldn't allow a general motion. Now, we've been told that general motions have been made. But I'm going to put back on my problem-solving hat, okay? And this is your chance to be a lawyer, right, for this, right, for your client, Mr. Bien. Okay? If the secretary were to offer to remand this matter to the board to a different VLJ, which I understand that was said, for the development of the constitutional claim, because we've heard them say here today that every piece of information you want is subject to getting by that different VLJ, and that my words, not the secretary's, everything is on the table in terms of the claim. It wouldn't be limited just to the constitutional claim. It would be all open, right? Would your client do something like that?
Yes, Your Honor, our client would consent to a remand on the condition that it be to a different VLJ. We, as I noted earlier, we additionally asked this court set a schedule for decision by the board because this case has been pending for over 7 years now, and BN has been seeking disability benefits for a sensitive MST claim for quite a while. And we ask this court to clarify how veterans may bring general bias claims in the future because it is unclear at this point how veterans may use the regulations available, if at all, in order to ensure a fair and impartial adjudication.
How could we do that last bit, though, in a joint motion to remand, right? Because, I suppose the secretary could try to say something, but I don't think that that would happen, right? I mean, at this point, while we are an appellate court and we are making law nationwide, right? At the end of the day, your job is to be in, right? And so if it remains unclear down the road how to bring a general bias claim, but your client's claim is granted at 100%, you win, right?
Yes, Your Honor. And it is first and foremost important that if this court should choose to remand, that it be to a different BLJ to ensure a fair and impartial adjudication of BN's claim. Because it is unclear how general bias claims may be brought in the future, we believe that that is additionally important for this court to clarify. But we indicate that our primary concern is that if this court should choose to remand and choose not to exercise its authority under the All Writs Act to order production, that it be to a different VLJ to ensure fair and impartial adjudication of this claim.
Ms. Lee, I wonder, I understand your point about a different VLJ, but I'm a little curious about your schedule for decision.
which I fully support a short time period for decisions. We haven't gotten there yet in this system, unfortunately. I think we need to do something about it. But 60 days, that would include development of the information that's not here in addition to a decision. Is that your suggestion?
Yes, Your Honor. We just merely suggest 60 days. Yeah. We ask this court to set a schedule in order to ensure.
I'm just curious if you thought 60 days was a reasonable time to get the information and make a decision.
Yes, Your Honor, we think so.
Yes is good enough. Thank you.
In addition, Your Honor, BN was not in a position to bring this claim of general bias during the 2014 remand and decision before the board. He had no reason to think that the VLJ would deny his claim or be biased at that point in time. As the Secretary mentioned, Judge Greenberg did issue an opinion in that case. And if we could direct this court's attention to RBA, page 40, which is Judge Greenberg's opinion in that case denying the petition for writ of mandamus, he indicated in that case that recognizing that BN has been waiting at that point for nearly 4 years to adjudicate the merits of his claim, that and he urged the VA to be mindful that under 38 CFR section 3.304F5, that a veteran's account of stressor incidents may be corroborated by other evidence other than in-service treatment records, and that may be sufficient to substantiate his PTSD claim without further development of the record. So at that point in time, the veteran didn't have a reason to think that the VLJ would be biased. Moreover, the VLJ did not identify an issue of bias until after the BVA had denied his claim in July 2016.
I'm curious, what prompted the discovery of what now we'll call, just for sake of argument, the prima facie case of bias?
Yes, Your Honor, when the VLJ denied BN's claim in July 2016, we believe and we contend that the VLJ incorrectly weighed the evidence in the BN's case against the grant of his disability benefits claim. And so at that point in time, counsel looked at the VLJ's decisions across the 10-year period of her time on the board and identified that the VLJ had only granted one male MST claim in the course of 10 years on the board, which represents a 2.8% grant rate as opposed to 44.4% grant rate. And in order to facilitate this court's review of a general bias claim and determine whether or not general bias may have colored BN's decision in this case, we filed a motion for production asking this court to exercise its authority.
So it was basically just, this is not negative, but it was basically just a shot in the dark? Nothing prompted. It's almost like playing Battleship, right? You said F5 and you actually hit the battleship. You just, not you personally, but after losing at the board without any indication at that point that there was any bias, you just decided to look for that?
Your Honor, we believe that there was an indication of bias in the decision itself, but we recognize that this court has applied the Leidecky v. United States standard in that information, that the opinion itself cannot indicate a general bias claim or provide for a general bias claim. Moreover, Judge Greenberg's, the VLJ ignored Judge Greenberg's opinion in his opinion on the petition for a writ of mandamus and that I have just quoted. And that further indicated that the VLJ was not fairly and partially adjudicating BN's claim.
So looking at how, particularly in this case, the VLJ decided the case, weighed the evidence, which, if I recall, there's an awful lot of evidence on credibility issues with respect to BN. But you're saying that based on how the VLJ weighed that evidence, that gave you an indication that there might be bias generally.
Your Honor, both the VLJ's denial as well as the previous opinion issued by this court indicating that the evidence currently in BN's record before the agency may have been sufficient to support his PTSD claim for disability benefits. The VLJ did not indicate an awareness of that opinion in her decision denying BN's benefits in July 2016. And the further information that we've determined after the denial, the one male MST grant rate representing 1/15 the grant rate of female MST claimants, we believe is sufficient to support a prima facie case of general bias. And through seeking additional records here today in order to further facilitate review of that general bias claim. Your Honors, issue exhaustion is inappropriate in this case. Under Sims v. Bell, issue exhaustion is inappropriate in a non-adversarial system. And under Maggott v. West, this court has recognized that the Federal Circuit has recognized that when there is some doubt as to whether the regulations are adequate, that issue exhaustion would be inappropriate to invoke in this case. For this reason, we ask this court to order production under the All Writs Act in order to ensure a fair and impartial adjudication of BN's general bias claim. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all. The case is submitted for consideration. The court will now come down to recounsel.